This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Unrest and violence have moved from country to country in the Middle East since the popular uprising in Tunisia began in 2010. Syria's bloody revolution spilled into Lebanon this week. A funeral for an anti-Syrian cleric set off a night of street fighting in Beirut. The UN estimates that 9,000 people have died in Syria since the revolution began in March of 2011, and it's lasted much longer than the uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. Yet Syria's President Bashar al-Assad shows no signs of stepping down, and humanitarian crisis on the ground in Syria grows more desperate every day. Miriam Cook is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University. She's the author of several books about the Middle East, including Dissident Syria. And she joins me from a studio at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, where she's been teaching. Welcome, Miriam.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You've written extensively about what you call the atomization of Syrian society before the revolution. Explain what you mean by that.
Yes. Hannah Arendt, in her analyses of the Holocaust, wrote about atomization, and it is a process that one can see happening in many of the Arab countries where people felt so terrorized by the dictatorships, by the fear that friends and family might be writing reports, that there was general mistrust. And the what Arendt talks about is the establishment of a very special kind of paternalistic relationship between the atomized individual, each one who feels an atom feels very much alone, and the ruler. And this was the situation in Syria, also in Iraq. I say around the Arab world because in the Arab Spring countries, Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and Libya, there was a measure of atomization, but not to the same extent as in Syria and Iraq. There is an expression in Arabic that I think tells it all, and that is al-hitan idhan, which is not walls have ears, but walls are ears. Mm. But so that people were afraid at home.
So, but this is the kind of thing that that supports any dictatorship, it seems, or is important to any dictatorship, a fear that your neighbor, your own family might turn you in. Is it fundamentally right. different in Syria? Are you saying that there was more cohesion and perhaps a more intact kind of opposition or opposition groups in Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt than there is in Syria?
I think that the absolute terror of expressing openly one's opposition to the regime was not as great as it was in Syria. I was in Syria between 95 and 96. And although I was able to write a book about the dissidents there, I met with them individually. It was only towards the end of my time there that I heard one person use the word muqawama, which is opposition. Whereas in those other countries where I had been, people talked among themselves fairly openly about opposition. But what I think is important for us to think about as we were amazed at, with the Arab Spring breaking out in these various one country after the other, and then moving to Syria, is that in some ways it was foretold. And it was foretold as early as the 1930s. And I'm wondering if, can I read you part of a poem?
Oh, sure.
By a Tunisian who in 1932 wrote a poem to the tyrants of the world. His name is Abul Qasim Ashabi, and this is 80 years ago, where he writes, "Hey, you despotic tyrant, darkness lover and enemy of life, you scoffed at a powerless people's groans and your hands are tainted with their blood. Woe betide you, for flames are underneath ashes. Who grows prickles, reaps wounds. have a look there, where you cut off the people's heads and the flowers of hope. You imbued the heart of the earth with blood and made it drunk with tears. The flood of blood will wipe you away, and the flaring gale will eat you up. So this is 1932, and whereas in Tunisia one might have said, well, yes, there might have been a revolution, I think it would have been impossible to think that in a country as atomized and terrorized as Syria that this might happen.
Miriam Cook is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern studies at Duke. She's written a number of books, including one called Dissident Syria. And I want to bring in someone else into the conversation now. Audrey Anne Lavallee-Berlanger is a rising senior at UNC Chapel Hill. She's a Moorhead scholar studying Arabic and anthropology, and she's been a good chunk of this past school year in Damascus University, also working in refugee camps at the Syria-Turkey border and the Syria-Jordan border. She joins us now from a studio in her native Montreal. Audrey Anne, welcome.
Thanks for having me. First of all, I'd like to precise some things. I was actually in Damascus in January of 2011, yeah. So only for barely a month, but I was able to note that people were very scared, like Dr. Cook was talking about Bashar al-Assad, and it's a really strong dictatorship. So I had my experience there. I made really great friends, and I was actually back for like a week in March when the first events in Deraa, when the school kids were writing graffitis on the school walls and they've been tortured and killed. So I was there when people started rising up, but I was actually studying in Turkey. What I did is, since I had a lot of friends and connections in Syria, is I really wanted to do something for Syria. And when the refugees started coming in the Turkish camps, I went there to freelance for the French-Canadian press there. And then I went to Jordan over Christmas break this year to see if the situation of the refugees in Jordan was different than the situation that I noticed in Turkey.
And was it?
It was extremely different, I think, because of Turkey's policy. It was really interesting because when I was there, the camps were actually closed. So that was in June 19th of last year. The camps were closed and journalists were not allowed to go in. So there were about three installations at that point. It was at the Antakya, in the Antakya province at the Syrian border. And journalists were not allowed to go in. They were quite upset. I think that the Turkish government tried to remain a sort of credible negotiator for Syria. So although they were maintaining their humanitarian duties, they wanted to make sure that they would still be able to keep the dialogue going with Bashar.
Well, I want to also ask you about your experience in Damascus, because I know that you've documented the work of a friend of yours who built a hospital in his hometown. Tell us his story.
Correct. So that's a friend that I met in Palmyra, and he actually met me again in Jordan when I went for Christmas break. And our plan was, because I speak quite a bit of Arabic, but I don't master all the dialects, and I wanted to go to the border with him to document the lives of the people at the Jordanian border. Unfortunately, that was kind of hard because although the camps were not closed like in Turkey, there was police patrol around to make sure that there wouldn't be secret Syrian agents threatening the refugees. So all my camera, all my media equipment was taken out. So I decided to make a story about him because his story is actually quite interesting. He is from the town of Palmyra, which is about 160 kilometers from Homs, where we've heard in the media where it's sort of one of the strongholds of the opposition. And what he did is there's Homsi refugees who started coming in around December, January, February of this year. And he decided to, along with friends, build a makeshift hospital hidden in the oasis. Now, the geography of Palmyra is really interesting because it's a desert town, and so it's really easy for rebels to hide. So he had this sort of geographic advantage for him, but at the same time, it was scary because there's a lot of tanks that started coming in, and at some point, we thought the city was besieged. But what he did is basically helping out people who were in the protests and were getting shot and did not have access to this governmental care, this health care, because what happens is the doctors, with or against their own will, are forced to report to the secret police what kind of patients are coming in and what they're coming in for. So in order to protect these people and make sure that they don't get killed, he would bring them in to the hospital. And everything was improvised. So they would ask their friends who were nurses to come in and help. Obviously, it was really dangerous, and they had to speak in codes because, you know, all the phones are tapped. So if you need more equipment and more material, you have to make these requests with different language codes. So it brings another perspective to the kind of problems that people encounter in these specific areas that where the opposition is operating.
We will find out what happened to him and the hospital when our conversation continues. Audrey-Anne Lavallee-Berlanger is a rising senior at UNC, studies Arabic and anthropology. Miriam Cook is a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern studies at Duke. And when we return after a short break, novelist Samia Sarageldin joins us. She'll help us consider the upcoming elections in Egypt, as well as our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the situation in Syria with Miriam Cook, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke, and Audrey-Anne Lavallee-Berlanger, a rising senior at UNC Chapel Hill, a Moorhead Scholar. Tomorrow she leaves for the capital of Qatar, Doha, where she will work with Al Jazeera this summer. Let me ask you, Miriam, what we haven't talked about is support for the regime in Syria. Is there support, and where does it come from?
There certainly has been a lot of coverage of support for the regime, and I suspect that these are people who remain very afraid of the consequences. But I think we also have to hope that time is on the side of the demonstrators. In his recently published book, Revolution 2.0, where he writes about the Egyptian uprising and his witness to it, Wael Ghanem, the Middle East representative for Google, writes, demonstrators who were attacked once will come back again and again, and that the government is afraid of the snowball effect. So my hope is that time is on the side of the demonstrators, but also that those who claim to support the regime, but who do so out of continued terror, will join with the opposition.
Is it only fear for what might happen to them if they were to join the opposition, or fear of what might happen if this regime passes into other hands, people who have actually benefited by the Assad regime?
Well, of course, Bashar al-Assad has said exactly what his father said in 1982 when Hafez Assad razed to the ground the Sunni city of Hama in the north of Syria. And that is, I'm controlling the plague of Islamism, and if I had not destroyed Hama, then the Muslim Brothers would have taken over, and so I'm protecting the world from the plague of Islamism. And that's exactly what Hafez Assad is saying today.
It's one thing, of course, to create a revolution and topple a dictator, quite another to then build a new government in its place. Egypt now is in the process of doing that. And this week, Egyptians will go to the polls for their first contested presidential election ever. Joining us now is Samia Seragaldin, a Chapel Hill-based Egyptian-born novelist and writer. Samia, welcome back to the program.
It's lovely to be here.
You recently returned from another trip to Egypt. Let's take a look at, before we get to Egypt, how people in Egypt are seeing what's going on in Syria. How is that being reflected there?
Well, there's a great deal of solidarity for the Syrian revolution. And in fact, on the first anniversary of January 25th, so in January 25th of 2012, there was a huge tent called the Syrian Solidarity Tent, and Syrian flags everywhere. So there's a great deal of solidarity among the people. How that translates into actual support for the revolutionaries, that is not clear, because that has to come, of course, from the government. And at the moment, the government is the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and they are not actually implementing any kind of actual support. There's also possibly two reasons for this. One may be that Egypt is mired in its own problems, and the other could be some concern or lingering concern about a Shiite bloc of some sort in the Middle East.
What's the feeling about this election? As you said, there's a military council that still runs the country. There have been parliamentary elections. There is an elected parliament, and yet it's still being run by the military. Is there? How are people feeling going into this election? Are they optimistic?
They are optimistic, but cautiously so. One of the some of the main demands of the revolution, a very few, have been met. The removal of Mubarak, for instance, and relatively free parliamentary elections, both of these. However, the transition to civilian rule that was promised, that has not come about yet. The SCAF, the military council, is promising that that will happen after the presidential elections. But the main problem is the lack of a constitution. Without setting a new constitution, there is no way of knowing what powers this elected president will have. And that is the football that the military, the Islamist Muslim, or I should really say the Muslim Brotherhood Party, because they are the group that has a majority in parliament. That is the football that is going back and forth, because whichever party feels that it will dominate the presidential elections, it's in it that party's interest to give the new president great powers in the constitution, whereas the party that fears that it might be the loser would like to limit those powers. So really, the constitution should come before the parliamentary elections. But that is something that at the moment is not happening, and constitutional committees have been formed and dissolved, and that issue really remains to be resolved, but it's the major problem.
I want to turn this question around a little bit and see how the events in Egypt are playing in Syria. Audrey-Anne, do you have a sense about the Egyptian elections, whether or not people pay attention and whether they have any bearing on what's going on in Syria?
I must say that my specialty is really not Egypt, although I did have something to go back to Dr. Cook's intervention. I personally feel, if I may speak about the support for Bashar al-Assad, is that okay with you?
Sure.
Yeah, I personally feel that it's hard to talk about the events in Syria because we are not inside Syria, but there's more and more social media that tells us that there is a support for Bashar al-Assad, both at the internal level but also at the regional level. I also traveled to Lebanon, where I noticed that people were very divided because they see the Syrian uprising in a Israeli-Lebanese lens. So I met this man who was in support of Bashar because the opposition, the people opposing Bashar, didn't give him a guarantee that they would fund the Hezbollah, so the Shia group in Lebanon, which is protecting Lebanese from Israeli invasion. So I think that people in Syria, some of them support Bashar al-Assad also because of the lack of an alternative to his his rule, we saw 2 weeks ago there were emails that were leaked from Burhan Ghalioun's email account. Burhan Ghalioun is the president of the Syrian National Council. The Syrian National Council now is considered the group that would come to power were Bashar, if Bashar were to fall. And basically in those emails, we find that Burhan Ghalioun and this SNC people are speaking with American agents, talking, you know, about the how to move Bashar from power and convince him that he would not be convicted if he were to leave. So I think that the fears that people have, people who are still on the fence and who are not necessarily supporting those civic, those legitimate civic claims that people are making in Syria, are afraid that this would just reconfigure the whole of the Middle East. And to go back to the Egyptian case, I think that the word that we're using in the media, uprising, they were applicable to the Tunisian and the Egyptian case in a sense that it was something that was completely, as we've seen in the media, completely not seen coming by Americans. But in my opinion, what's happening in Libya, in Syria, seems to have been somehow initiated or is now being worked on by foreigners that are concerned at the shift in rule in the Middle East. So that's my take on it.
Miriam Cook, is there a sense that there's more foreign involvement in this revolution?
I would say certainly now it's obvious that there is. It is clear that Iran is regularly supplying the regime with arms, the support, of course, of Russia, particularly, but China also has been significant. And the opposition is also being armed from the outside. I am not so sure about this having been started from the outside, because I don't think that you can get mass demonstrations if by the people, and there are too many people out in the streets for these all to be foreigners. And I'd like to draw your attention to what happened on May 19th, so only a few days ago, that the largest protest of the entire uprising was in Aleppo. And so that takes me back to what I was saying earlier, quoting Ronim, that demonstrators who have been attacked in a way sort of like a hornet's nest are going to get angrier and angrier. Certainly there are foreign elements, and the longer that this lasts, the more that outside forces will be involved. But this is certainly an uprising by the people.
Samiyad, now going back to Egypt, the idea of all this energy behind the revolution itself that overthrows Mubarak, is there a sense that it is in any way coalesced and is now part of the energy behind these political campaigns, or are they completely different animals in a way?
No, definitely. I think you asked about optimism earlier, and if I can bring that into this question as well. In spite of all the problems, I think the optimism has to come from the fact that all of these energies are going towards elections. Whether it is the referendum on the Constitution, March 2011, whether it is the parliamentary elections, November, December, whether it is this coming presidential election, just the fact that people, even if they disagree with the outcome or are apprehensive about the outcome, they are absolutely believing in and invested in the electoral process, in spite of illiteracy, in spite of all the problems associated with elections in Egypt, in spite sometimes of daunting conditions. This belief, this faith, this enthusiasm in the electoral process, which is basically the democratic process, is what gives me a lot of hope and optimism about Egypt, because no matter what side of the equation people are on, political equation, there is this complete investment in elections as the way to bring about change.
Are all factions who were part of the revolution, are they represented in this presidential race?
I think probably the young, secular, liberal youth who originally organized and launched the demonstrations that brought about the revolution, they do not have the candidate of their choice to vote for. He's not up there. Even Mohamed El Barede, who would have been their candidate of choice, he's not running. So it must be very frustrating for them to have to choose between lesser of several evils, either secular candidates who represent to some greater or lesser extent collaboration with the old regime, historically, I mean not currently, but in their history, or Islamist candidates who are either independent and moderate and liberal, or can run the gamut to quite hardline and extreme. So they do not have the choice of the candidate of their choice, and that must be very frustrating for them.
Well, speaking of that frustration, and you speak of optimism, it's surprising in a way. I mean, I think I've read reports that some rights groups have reported that more than 10,000 people have been referred to military courts since Mubarak fell. That's four times the number he had in the military courts. So I guess I'll ask it in a different way, whether or not people there's no sense of futility. It's not like, okay, we're going to have these elections, but someday the military will step down and someday the democratic regime will take power.
No, that is the hope, absolutely, that there will be a transition to civilian rule. I shouldn't oversimplify. There's certainly a sector of society that is that either lost in many ways after the fall of the Mubarak regime, or even a sector of society that is just putting security as its primary and perhaps only concern, that wouldn't mind a military presence, even a military takeover, for the immediate future, with the idea of restoring law and order. But precisely that is what the opposition is saying. Well, the military are using extremely violent tactics that even in Mubarak's day were not used. And this is compromising the prestige of the military with the people, because up to now the military in Egypt did have a certain standing as representing the people, as being patriotic, and had not been turned against the people as it has in other regimes. So it is very worrying. It is very worrying, but the big change, I think, I would say, from before Mubarak's day is that there is the psychological barrier of fear has completely dissolved. And you keep hearing from the young people, especially over and over, we now know the way to Tahrir. There's no turning back. So elections will be given a fair chance, but if ever the military do show signs of having no intention of handing over to civilians, I expect it will be more turmoil, which, of course, for many people is the last thing they want.
Pressure from the U.S. and other countries, of course, were helpful in all of these revolutions. The U.S. was more actively involved in Libya, but Miriam, not so in Syria. Is there something about Syria, its a strategic position, that accounts for this, do you think? Why not? Why is the U.S. and other countries, certainly Russia, France, all the rest, not willing to get involved here?
Such a good question, and I wish I had the answer. And I think of this. I've actually written a couple of op-eds precisely on this subject, because I feel in some ways what we are doing here is what was said after World War II would never happen again, and that is that we would be bystanders to atrocities. And every single day I get, and I'm sure many others do too, I get vivid gruesome reports from the Syrian Networks for Human Rights. It's a violations report that comes out sometimes daily, sometimes two or three times a week, where it's name by name. It's often with YouTubes that are virtually unwatchable. And clearly what the hope is that if people are informed, that they will do something about it. At this point, it just seems that things have gone so far that for the U.S. to become involved now would escalate the violence in the region. And, of course, with Syria having as its closest ally Iran, and with Israel threatening Iran and Iran threatening Israel, there is that triangle. And as was earlier mentioned, clearly what is happening in Lebanon is going to aggravate the situation. So every day I think it becomes harder and harder for the U.S. to become involved.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Miriam Cook, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke, the author of several books, including Dissident Syria. Audrey Ann Lavallee-Berlanger is a rising senior at UNC Chapel Hill. She's a Moorhead scholar studying anthropology and Arabic and will spend this summer working for Al Jazeera. Samia Sarah-Geldin is a Chapel Hill-based Egyptian-born novelist, among her books, The Cairo House. Coming up from the Middle East to Pittsburgh, hyperlocal North Carolina Hops and Roots Festival. Stay with us on The State of Things.